From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Lower Haight.
Outer Richmond.
Fremont.
South of Market.
The Marina.
The E.
Trail Hill. The Dirty 94107.
I'm from Israel, living in Santa Clara.
Coming up, we'll hear how San Francisco's startup world is looking to revolutionize the food industry.
They provide me the relief I need to focus on what I'm good at, which is raising chickens that lay delicious eggs.
And a love story where bread is the main character.
I think right now I'm still in like that newlywed kind of stage with baking.
Then choral music that everyone can rock out to.
Anybody can do it. My friends who are into punk rock are all over it.
All of the elements of an interesting dinner party that's coming up today on Cross Currents. Even here in the environmentally conscious Bay Area, most food isn't farm to table. It's farm to processor, to distributor, to wholesaler, to retailer, to you, the consumer, and only then to your table. But more and more shoppers want to know about this process and ultimately about where their food comes from.
I guess I do have a question about the chicken, if you could just tell us a little bit more about it.
The chicken is a heritage breed, woodland-raised chicken that's been fed a diet of sheep's milk, soy, and hazelnuts.
Okay, this is local?
Yes, absolutely.
I'm going to ask you just one more time, and it's local?
It is.
Is that USDA organic or Oregon organic or Portland organic?
It's just all across the board, organic.
The hazelnuts, these are local?
How big is the area where the chickens are able to roam free?
I'm sorry to interrupt. I have exactly the same question.
4 acres.
Even though that restaurant scene from the TV show Portlandia is a bit over the top, elements of it are commonplace in high-end Bay Area restaurants. But today, this information comes at a price, both to consumers and to farmers. How do you make locally sourced organic food more accessible while still making it profitable for farmers? That's the question that a group of food lovers and techies are teaming up to answer. KALW's Mary Willis files this story about San Francisco's food startup scene.
How was everything last week?
Good.
It's good?
Yeah.
On a Wednesday afternoon in the Mission District, a white van has pulled up to the curb and opened its doors.
I just needed eggs this week.
Just eggs?
Just eggs
cool,
this
good,
week.
Good.
I know. You guys have good quality eggs for probably the cheapest price right now.
Yeah,
inside are shelves lined with bags of meat, bread, eggs, fruit, and fresh vegetables. And one by one, customers stop by, but they aren't here to browse.
Yeah.
I don't expect it to stay that way.
Well, let's hope.
Chances are you've used the internet to buy clothes, books, or gifts. It's probably less likely to be your go-to spot for apples, lettuce, or beef. And that's exactly what Good Eggs, the company that owns this van, is trying to change.
I got a lot this time.
You got a lot this week?
Yep.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. See you next week.
See you next week.
Adios.
Here's how it works. People go to the Good Eggs website and select which food they want to buy. There's all sorts of things, even baby food. It's all grown organically wherever possible, and the growers and producers are all local. Once the order's placed, Good Eggs coordinates with the farmers and food makers who deliver their products to the tech company's warehouse in the Dogpatch district. Good Eggs then either delivers the order directly to the customers, which costs about $4, or it can be picked up at vans around the city. Today, 20 to 30 people will drop past during the hour to collect their food, including Rebecca Sawyer.
Today I got eggs, bread, asparagus, strawberries, and pork chops, and walnut butter, which, I mean, you know, sounds like it might be good.
Sawyer says buying through Good Eggs is slightly cheaper than buying at organic grocery stores, though she says it's not always more convenient. But for her, it's better than the alternative.
Oh, forget it. I haven't been to a supermarket in years.
There are more and more customers thinking like Sawyer, which is why farmers' markets are blossoming across the nation. 25 markets are held each week in San Francisco alone. Still, the local food market only makes up less than 1% of food sales across the US. That could change as the tech sector gets more and more involved in the business of farming.
Okay, so imagine it's 6 p.m., you're on your way home from work, you're really tired, and all you want to do at that point is have a nice home-cooked meal for dinner.
This is Food Hackathon. In a warehouse near the Soma district of San Francisco, about 200 engineers, designers, and foodies are coming up with new ideas to build technology products and tools specifically for the food industry. The day starts out with people standing up in front of the crowd with 1 minute to pitch their idea.
So I need anyone who's opinionated about food or fun to work with me to actually get everyone addicted to leveling up from their lettuce, to be socially shamed by their friends when they forget to monitor their soil moisture and otherwise.
One of the mentors at the hackathon is Nathan Jones, who's founder of a startup called AgLocal. It connects independent farmers and ranchers directly with chefs. His in-laws are farmers in Kansas.
Just hearing their stories of how they would see their friends' names on menus, but they know that that person's really poor. But on the menu, you know, the steak's like, you know, $80 meal. It's like, but this doesn't make sense. Like, this person that I know, their name's right there. That's a poor person, but this steak is $80 on this menu. So obviously there's like a problem there.
Across the US, farmers make less than 16 cents for every dollar consumers spend on food. There are some existing models to help them make more than that. Farmers markets, for example, or community-supported agriculture subscriptions, CSAs.
Hi, I run an online farmer's market. I'm the founder.
Lauren Bass runs an online market called Lollabies. Like Good Eggs, it connects consumers with local cooks, farmers and food makers. She got into this business because she wanted to find a better way than the CSA.
You get too much food that goes to waste. You don't get a lot of variety. And you have to go pick it up from a farmer, you know, in a parking lot somewhere between 3 and 5 on a Wednesday.
And she says many consumers won't go to a farmer's market every week either.
So basically, we're giving farmers access to that group of people.
I appear to know my way around now, but, you know, first several trips to the city here was a little intimidating.
At 6 o'clock on a Sunday morning, I join egg producer Dan Martin on his weekly deliveries around San Francisco.
Hi, I'm Dan Martin. They call me Dan the Eggman. I own and operate the Lazy 69 Ranch, which is a free-range organic egg operation with my wife and two young kids.
Martin's one of Lollabies' producers. He also supplies markets like Rainbow Grocery and Buyrite. Every Sunday morning, he gets up at 1:30 to pack his truck.
So this is Egg Force One.
Once Egg Force One is loaded up, he then makes the four-hour journey to San Francisco from his property in Northern California. His 3,000 hens produce up to 12,000 eggs each week.
You know, from a guy that earns his living, you know, an egg at a time, an expensive parking ticket is like throwing a case of eggs out the window.
Martin says selling through the startup gives him the freedom to concentrate on the farm.
Because my operation is a seven-day-a-week operation, and so I would have to be theoretically at a farmer's market every day of the week trying to sell my eggs, whereas they provide me the relief I need to focus on what I'm good at, which is raising chickens that lay delicious eggs.
Martin says he sells his eggs for the same price to each buyer, but he likes the control over his product and relationship he has with the startup as compared to a larger market.
I have no say-so or no influence on the retail price of my eggs, and so often is the case they see the opportunity to capture profits off of our hard work and, say, selling our eggs, retailing them for $10 a dozen or something more than that, which is a lot of money for a dozen eggs.
Instead, Martin says selling online keeps the retail price low and allows him to sell more. He says food startups have a future.
I believe it's going to require sincere startups like Lollabies to keep farmers like me sustainable.
Back at Food Hackathon, the crowd is mingling, making connections and discussing ideas for food websites, apps and companies. So what is the next big thing for food?
What we're doing basically is investigating the potential for the use of insects in feeding the world.
Daniel Imri Sitanaiki is co-founder of a company called Tiny Farms. He says there are already companies experimenting with the use of cricket flour in protein bars, and consumers in Thailand are using insects directly in meals.
America obviously isn't really ready for that right now, but across the world, any possible way you can imagine insects being used in food, they are the same as any other type of food, basically.
Which means maybe soon you'll be able to order your snack of insects online. In San Francisco, I'm Mary Willis for CrossCurrents.
What are your tactics for making local and organic food more affordable or easier to buy? You can let us know at our tip line. Just leave us a message at 415-264-7106. That number again to leave us a message and we'll try to feature your voice on the air is 415-264-7106. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. Even though ordering food online may speed up the process of buying ingredients, when it comes to cooking them, some folks like to take it slow, especially when it comes to bread. And that's the subject of our next story from our community storytelling project, Hear, Hear.
Hear?
Hear?
Hear.
Hear.
Okay, together. Okay.
Hear, Hear.
From KALW.
San Francisco is well known for its bread, especially its sourdough, which gets its flavor from a special kind of bacteria in the air here. Combine that with some yeast, flour, and water, let it rise and bake it, and you'll get a uniquely San Franciscan loaf.
Finger licking good.
But it's not that easy, as the subject of our next story can attest to. He's been trying to master the art of sourdough since he got his first baking job in the city just over a year ago.
Baking bread is one of those things that it's a really magical process. My name is Ryan Lee. I live in the outer sunset of San Francisco, a few blocks from the sea. I grew up in the Midwest with kind of a pretty simple meat and potatoes upbringing, and as I got older, I started tinkering in the kitchen. It's become a bit of an obsession, and recently I kind of transitioned to San Francisco, and I arrived, and there was a bakery opening right in the neighborhood, and so I approached the owners of the bakery and applied for a job that I wasn't qualified for at all as a baker. You know, I had a little bit of experience baking bread at home, but that was really it. And I met with the owners, and we just kind of hit it off, and we made a deal with one another. They told me that if I would work the front of house for the first bit, that they would hire me on as a baker once something was available. About 2 weeks later, they hired me on as a baker with pretty much zero experience. So in the last year, I've learned to bake. I would not say I'm really good at this, no. I think right now I'm still in like that newlywed kind of stage with baking. I'm baking way more than I could ever eat. So hopefully, I guess my dream is to move away someday, somewhere quiet, where I can open a little spot of my own, where I can serve up what I feel is like the perfect marriage of some tasty soup and fresh baked bread.
That story was recorded at the Ortega Branch Library in San Francisco as part of our community storytelling project, Hear, Hear. It was produced by Erica Moo. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan. So if our first stories have you in a food coma, don't worry. This next one should snap you right out of it. What you're hearing is called sacred harp singing. It's considered one of the oldest forms of American folk music. It dates back to the 1700s to a choral style that developed in the churches of colonial New England, but eventually took root in the rural South. It's a participatory tradition, which means that singers perform for themselves and not for an audience. Recently, Sacred Harp has been experiencing something of a renaissance. Some even characterize it as the punk rock of choral music. Music lovers have been rediscovering this singing style all over the country and even abroad. Shani Aviram went to Berkeley to find out what's drawing people to revive this 200-year-old tradition in this story from our archives.
This is not a rehearsal. It's not a performance either, but these singers are belting out the tunes. The Bay Area Sacred Harp Group usually meets in Berkeley, but today there are about 60 people crammed in a small wooden room at the Potrero Hill neighborhood house in San Francisco. They're sitting around a hollow square where each side represents a voice in a four-part harmony: bass, tenor, alto, and treble.
What is Sacred Harp?
That's Hannah Blair, an artist from San Francisco.
I have been working on a short explanation of this, actually, ever since I got this tattoo.
She points to the notes of a hymn called Africa, tattooed on her left arm. It's written in shape notes, rectangles, diamonds, and triangles.
And realized the very next day that I was going to spend the rest of my life explaining Sacred Harp to people.
Sacred Harp is one of the oldest forms of American folk music. It was developed in the churches of New England 200 years ago. The brash singing style quickly died out as music scholars of the day dismissed it as too crude for church. The tradition eventually took root in the rural South, where it is still sung to this day. Since the 1980s, Sacred Harp has experienced what some call an urban revival in cities all over the country. But even as the music catches on with a new generation of singers, Blair still finds it hard to explain its appeal without adding a few disclaimers.
You know, I'm not religious, and it's, you know, San Francisco. We sing in church, you know, but like it's just in a church. It's not like at church, but I do feel sometimes like it's a bit of a guilty pleasure in San Francisco.
It's a guilty pleasure because the words are steeped in evangelical Christian theology.
Well, the words are a stumbling block for a lot of people when they start singing the music.
That's Dan Harper. He's a minister at the Unitarian Church in Palo Alto. He says even if you have a problem with the religious lyrics of Sacred Harp, that doesn't have to stop you from singing it.
So there's a lot of people who sing all kinds of music and they have no interest in the words at all, but they just like the music. So you think about a lot of the American standards right out of the American songbook, and the words are totally meaningless. I mean, Moonlight Over Vermont, who the hell cares about Moonlight Over Vermont? But we sing it because it's a wonderful song. So I think a lot of people approach Sacred Harp music that way, is you don't worry too much about the words.
And the singing itself can be a hard sell. Sacred Harp is loud. The harmonies are unusual and not quite in tune. But music lovers of all walks of life are finding ways to relate to the 200-year-old tradition. Blair says the first time she attended the weekly singing in Berkeley, it took her back to her past when she was in a metal band.
We were a really noisy band. I did a lot of screaming, and there was something as different as being in the band was from Sacred Harp. There was something equally physical about Sacred Harp, you know, singing as loud as I could and running out of air in a lot of the songs. And then just the experience of making music with a bunch of people who were also really excited to be there. And it was a really intense experience to have with a bunch of strangers.
It's an intense experience for Harper, too, but for a different reason.
It's partly because anybody can do it. My friends who are into punk rock are all over it, because then I just tell them it's all about do-it-yourself music, and that gets a lot of people, too.
Like in punk rock, you don't have to be classically trained or be exactly on pitch to sing Sacred Harp songs. They're written in shape notes, a notation system that was designed to be easier to sight read so that anyone can pick it up and sing.
So we have four notes there. You have the triangle is fa.
Cassie Allen is a singer from Rome, Texas.
And you can say it fa or fa, either way. People sing it both ways. They kind of do a fa.
She's conducting a singing school for an enthusiastic Bay Area crowd.
Fa. That's how the old people do it.
Singing schools are part of the inclusive tradition of sacred harp and shape note singing. Their purpose was to teach congregations to sight sing so every member could take part in the service.
Part of sacred harp singing is blending. We don't care how loud you sing, really. We don't care if you sing off tune. But most of the time when you break up in parts like that, you tend to try to blend together.
Sacred harp is sung in four-part dispersed harmony. That means every vocal line can exist independently from one another. But when sung together, they create a unique texture of voices.
Oh, may we all, oh, may we all remember well.
As Alan explains, sacred harp is ultimately a communal experience. That's why it's about blending all these different voices together. She says it's not about how you sing. And Hannah Blair says it's also not about what you believe.
Part of the tradition is that it doesn't matter what your politics are, what your beliefs are, who you are, what you're doing. It's rare that you find a group that all you have to do is want to be a member. And you are.
Maybe that's why the sacred harp tradition travels so well outside of its southern home. It welcomes anyone who wants to do it. Blair says that she will always be a part of a larger community, no matter where a singing takes place. The rough sound and the religious tone might take newcomers some getting used to, but the experience of singing loudly in four-part harmony with a bunch of people is hard to resist. For Cross Currents, I'm Shani Aviram.
You can hear more local stories and more local music at klw.org. That's also where you can sign up for our podcast. And that's all for today's edition of Cross Currents. Our team includes Julie Kane, Lisa Carmack, Jen Chien, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Chris Hoff, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Isabel Angel, Alyssa Kapnick, Raisu Sussman, Melanie Young, Laura Sapinara, Christina Loring, Stephen Short, Nina Gensler-Debs, Holly McDeed, Ben Vu, Marco Choi, Christian Rose, and Megan Quintana. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. And thanks to you, we are listener-supported public radio. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We'll look at how receiving a hot meal can mean more than just nutrition.
That minute of exchange is such a high ritual when it has to do with sustenance and familiarity.
That's tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents. If you know this theme song, then you're familiar with West Coast Live, heard Saturday mornings on KALW. And you know that Mike Greensill, the program's resident piano player, is at the keyboard. The Mike Greensill Trio will be performing along with Wesla Whitfield on Saturday at the Piedmont Piano Company in Oakland. Music begins at 8 p.m. You can find all of that information along with more local bands at klw.org, and that's also where you can subscribe to our podcast. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.